Matthew 23, Part 1. The fourth talk about Jesus' teaching on Phariseeism was presented by Jack Crabtree on September 4, 2005, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2005. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We've been going through the Gospel of Luke, but I want to shift gears for one Sunday here and go to the Gospel of Matthew. Some of you know that we have a Bible study Thursday morning, and we've reached Matthew 23, and I've just been struck by this passage, intrigued by this passage. I think this is a really important teaching by Jesus, and I want to take some time to look at it here. In Matthew 23, we're at the end of Jesus' life, before his crucifixion. He's in Jerusalem for those last few days. Here he is in the temple. As you know, what it means to be in the temple is not to be inside of a building, but the temple was actually the whole site of a mountain in Jerusalem that was surrounded by thick, high walls and porticos, porches that surrounded the whole thing. And in the porticos, all kinds of teaching would take place, and people would assemble and gather together, and rabbis would teach their students and so on. And that's what Jesus is doing. He's out among the porticos in the temple teaching his disciples, and there is a crowd gathered around him. In this particular chapter, he's addressing both the disciples and the crowds. So this is not directed just at the disciples. And the reason this passage, I think, is so crucial, it's among the most explicit and penetrating condemnations of Phariseeism anywhere in Jesus' teaching. It really gets to the heart and to the essence of what the problem is with Phariseeism, and I think it's crucial that we understand that. Now, I can't prove this from a biblical text, but the reason I think that's so crucial is because I would maintain that Phariseeism is sort of the natural religion of mankind. Phariseeism comes in many different forms. Every religion has its form of Phariseeism. Christianity has its form of Phariseeism. This is not a Jewish problem. This is a human problem. And before I'm done, if I don't run out of time, I'm going to maintain, you may think it's outrageous, but I would ask you to consider this. This is not hyperbole. This is not a frivolous claim on my part. This is a serious claim on my part. It seems to me that mainstream evangelical Christianity is an institution of institutionalized Phariseeism. And for that reason, it's crucial that we understand it. Not because I'm expecting or urging you or advocating that we go out to all those churches and say, shame on you, you're not really Christians, you're just a bunch of Pharisees, but because I think it's incumbent upon all of us to come to the kind of understanding and the kind of discernment that we understand the difference between authentic spirituality, the authentic working of the Spirit of God in a person's life, and this other natural phenomenon of Phariseeism that overtakes people and seduces them and enslaves them, so that we can discern where people are at and in the quietness of our relationships with them, urge them, guide them, and direct them. You know, we don't need to lambast anybody or lambast any institutions, but we need to understand what's going on in human existence. And I don't think we can understand what's going on in human existence if we don't know the difference between faith and the religion of Phariseeism. So that's why I think this is such a crucial issue for us to come to terms with. Okay, let's look at the passage, Matthew 23. I'll read the whole thing. I won't have time this morning to comment on every detail. I want to focus on the things that I think get to the heart of the matter. Then Jesus spoke to the crowds and to his disciples, saying, "The scribes and the Pharisees have seated themselves in the chair of Moses. Therefore, all that they tell you, do and observe, but do not do according to their deeds, for they say things and do not do them. They tie up heavy burdens and lay them on men's shoulders, but they themselves are unwilling to move them with so much as a finger. but they do all their deeds to be noticed by men, for they broaden their phylacteries and lengthen the tassels of their garments. They love the place of honor at banquets and the chief seats in the synagogues, and respectful greetings in the marketplaces, and being called rabbi by men. But do not be called rabbi, for one is your teacher, and you are all brothers. And do not call anyone on earth your father, for one is your father, he who is in heaven. Do not be called leaders, for one is your leader, that is, Christ. But the greatest among you shall be your servant. Whoever exalts himself shall be humbled, and whoever humbles himself shall be exalted. But woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, because you shut off the kingdom of heaven from people, for you do not enter in yourselves, nor do you allow those who are entering to go in. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, because you devour widows' houses, and for a pretense you make long prayers, therefore you will receive greater condemnation. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, because you travel around on sea and land to make one proselyte, and when he becomes one, you make him twice as much a son of hell as yourselves. Woe to you, blind guides, who say, whoever swears by the temple, that is nothing, but whoever swears by the gold of the temple is obligated. You fools and blind men, which is more important, the gold or the temple that sanctified the gold? And whoever swears by the altar, that is nothing, but whoever swears by the offering on it, he is obligated. You blind men, which is more important, the offering or the altar that sanctifies the altar, the offering? Therefore, whoever swears by the altar swears both by the altar and by everything on it. And whoever swears by the temple swears both by the temple and by him who dwells within it. And whoever swears by heaven swears both by the throne of God and by him who sits upon it. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you tithe mint and dill and cumin, and have neglected the weightier provisions of the law, justice and mercy and faithfulness. But these are the things you should have done without neglecting the others. You blind guides who strain out a gnat and swallow a camel. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you clean the outside of the cup and of the dish, but inside they are full of robbery and self-indulgence. You blind Pharisee, first clean the inside of the cup and of the dish, so that the outside of it may become clean also. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you are like whitewashed tombs, which on the outside appear beautiful, but inside they are full of dead men's bones and all uncleanness. So you too outwardly appear righteous to men, but inwardly you are full of hypocrisy and lawlessness. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you build the tombs of the prophets and adorn the monuments of the righteous, and say, if we had been living in the days of our fathers, we would not have been partners with them in shedding the blood of the prophets. So you testify against yourselves that you are sons of those who murdered the prophets. Fill up then the measure of the guilt of your fathers. You serpents, you brood of vipers, how will you escape the sentence of hell? Therefore, behold, I am sending you prophets and wise men and scribes. Some of them will kill you and crucify, and some of them will scourge in your synagogues and persecute from city to city, so that upon you may fall the guilt of all the righteous blood shed on earth, from the blood of righteous Abel to the blood of Zechariah the son of Berechiah, whom you murdered between the temple and the altar. Truly I say to you, all these things will come upon this generation. I'll stop there. The first thing to notice here is this is obviously a scathing denunciation of the Pharisees. He doesn't mince words. He lambasts them. He condemns them to hell, basically, in his comments toward them. But what's crucial, we can ask the question, is that fair? I mean, is Jesus being fair to these guys? Because when you look at how the history of Christianity developed, when you look in the book of Acts, many Pharisees became believers. Well, if many Pharisees became believers, what is this blanket generalization, this condemnation of this whole set of people, this whole class of people called Pharisees? What's that all about? Well, I think it's crucial that we make a distinction between a culture and the people that are in that culture, the individual people that are in that culture. What Jesus is attacking here is the entire culture that this class of people has built. The structures, the institutions, the practices, the life that they have built around a certain theology and a certain set of assumptions. They have this whole life together that they have built as a culture. And that he's attacking. What does that mean about particular individuals within that culture? Well, it doesn't necessarily mean anything. Because as we know, some of the very people that he's lambasting here ultimately come their way to belief. And they come to become disciples of Jesus. So we have to make a distinction between the cultures that are rightly deserving of condemnation on the one hand, and not take it personally if we find ourselves within a culture that's being attacked by the truth of the scripture, that we don't take it as a personal attack. It's not a personal rejection. We're just involved in and tied in with and embedded in this culture that is built on stuff that is fundamentally against God and hostile to God. We have to make that distinction, I think. Oftentimes, we around here are criticized for being anti-church. And the reason that charge comes is because as we look at the Bible, look at the truths of the Bible, we see the Bible saying some things that challenge fairly seriously the practices, the attitudes, the mindset of mainstream Christian culture. And we point that out. And we suggest that if what the Bible is saying here is true, then this whole manifestation of Christianity in mainstream Christian culture is false, is in error. But there are a whole lot of people within the culture who don't like the fact that culture, those cultures that they identify with, are being called wrong or evil or whatever. And they point the finger back at us. You're against us. You're attacking us. You're hostile to us. Well, I hope you are all able to make the distinction that none of us should be hostile to the individuals in mainstream Christianity. There are many children of God, many children of light, many believers and followers of Jesus in all those churches out there across the land. And they are authentic and they're genuine and they're for real. And I wouldn't for a second write them off. Because God knows them, and God is leading them, and God is sanctifying them. But even though they as individuals may be fine in their relationship with God, there's still the culture. And we can see, we can read off of the practices and the things that are said and the things that are done and the attitudes that are taken by that culture at large and can measure it by the standard of truth. And we dare not do that. Of course we have to measure it by the standard of truth. That's how we keep our sanity. That's how we keep our perspective. That's how we keep our discernment sharp. And we need to call what's true, true, and we need to call what's in error, error. And I don't see how we can do anything other than that. Well, I think that's what Jesus is doing here in the context of Judaism in the first century, attacking the mainstream manifestation of Judaism in that time. And he's saying it's gone astray. It's on a wrong foundation. The mindset is evil. It's against God. And he's attacking the entire culture. Remember when you're going through Luke, we came across that passage where Jesus says you can't put new wine into old wineskins. That the structures, the culture, the institutions that we build are always a sort of a natural, organic, and logical outgrowth of the worldview and the mindset that creates them. And if the mindset that creates an institution is contrary to God, there's something about that structure and that institution that it's already diabolical. It's already demonic. It's already filled with hatred and hostility toward God. You can't then just take that and dump authentic faith into it and manifest authentic faith through that culture and those institutions. It can't work because faith is ultimately going to challenge and call into question the very foundation upon which that culture and those institutions are founded. Authentic faith needs to find its own expression. It needs to create its own culture and create its own institutions. It can't just take what's readily available. Well, that's why Phariseeism is not prepared to be the way in which authentic faith can express its faith It can't express its faith through the traditions and practices and rituals and religion of Phariseeism. And so Jesus goes on the attack here, and he attacks the very foundation of everything that their religion is based on. Perhaps the most crucial statement he makes is the first one. So let's look at the first two verses here, first two statements. Then Jesus spoke to the crowds and said to his disciples, crowds and his disciples, saying, "The scribes and the Pharisees have seated themselves in the chair of Moses. Therefore, all that they tell you, do and observe, but do not do according to their deeds, for they say things and do not do them." On the surface, it looks like what Jesus is saying is just flat out false. Because we know from looking at the Talmud that the Pharisees were well aware of the phenomenon of there being genuine Pharisees, authentic Pharisees, and inauthentic Pharisees, sincere Pharisees and insincere Pharisees. Over time, they developed names for, I think it was 9 different types of Pharisees. Only 8 types of Pharisees are declared by the Talmud to be real Pharisees, authentic, genuine, serious, sincere Pharisees. The rest of them are considered to be fraudulent and bogus and inauthentic expressions of the Pharisaical tradition. And they point out many of the same mistakes that Jesus is talking about. Pharisees that are in it for the money, Pharisees that are in it just for fame and glory, Pharisees that like the acclaim of other people. They're very well aware of that phenomenon and are trying to advocate for a kind of Phariseeism that's based on a sincere love of God. So it would appear on the surface that this is a cheap shot by Jesus. You're just picking on the insincere, inauthentic members of our culture and of our class, and you're dismissing the whole phenomenon of Phariseeism based on some bogus representatives of it. But I don't think that's what Jesus is saying. Jesus is not accusing them of not practicing what they preach. I think the Pharisees are famous for practicing what they preach. They're meticulous in practicing what they preach. So if that's what Jesus was saying, then he'd be wrong, I think. But I don't think that's what Jesus is saying. I think Jesus is making a far more profound point. When he says, "The scribes and the Pharisees have seated themselves in the chair of Moses, therefore all that they tell you do and observe, but do not do according to their deeds, for they say things, for they say, but do not do." Mine has "say things and do not do them," but I think that's a mistake by the translator. "For they say, but they do not do." Well, what is it that they're saying? Are they saying, pray 3 times a day, fast twice a week, tithe all of your spices, and so on and so forth, and yet they don't do those things? No, that's not right. They do say those things, but they also do them. But whether explicitly or implicitly, the message of Phariseeism is, do you want to be right with God such that you will be blessed by God in the age to come? Do you want the divine blessing that God has in store for you? If you want the divine blessing that God has in store for you, then you must prove yourself, show yourself worthy by means of keeping the Mosaic Covenant. I think that's what Jesus means when he says they have seated themselves in the chair of Moses. I don't know whether that was a well-known concept or idea or term, or whether Jesus is coining it. I'm not sure. I can't tell. But evidently what it means is they're presuming to be that prophetic voice that Moses was originally. They're presuming to be that same prophetic voice. And out of the authority of that prophetic office, they're telling you what you need to do in order to receive the divine blessing. And what is it that Phariseeism is telling you? Phariseeism is telling you that you must be worthy, and you show your worthiness by keeping the law. And if you'll do that, then God will bless you. I'm sorry, I'm getting ahead of myself. What it is that they're telling you, that he says, do it, but don't do it as they do it. What they're telling you is, keep the law of Moses. As prophets and seated in the chair of Moses, they're telling you, keep the law of Moses, keep the covenant. And then he says, yeah, do that. So Jesus is first acknowledging their message to their time. Do what they say, do keep the Mosaic covenant. But don't keep the Mosaic covenant the way they keep the Mosaic covenant. That's what he means by, but do not do according to their deeds. For they say, but they do not do. What is it they say? They say they are keeping the covenant, but in fact they are not keeping the covenant. I think that's what gets explored at length in Paul's letters, is the way in which Pharisaical Judaism and Pharisaical Christianity, in which Phariseeism makes a claim to be keeping the law, keeping the covenant, but in fact they are failing to do so, and then explains how it is that they're failing to do so. So for example, how is it that Phariseeism claims that they're keeping the law? They are meticulous in their practice of the ceremonial and religious items in the law. They're meticulous in that. But they conveniently avoid even looking at all the moral failure in their life. They're very religious, but they're not very moral. So Jesus is saying, how is it exactly that they're keeping the law? They're ignoring vast, important, substantial portions of the covenant. That's not keeping it. So don't keep the covenant the way they keep the covenant. But insofar as they are telling you keep the covenant, listen to them. That's good advice. That's good teaching. Yes, you should keep the covenant. Now, the next statement is where I got ahead of myself a little bit. They tie up heavy burdens and lay them on men's shoulders, but they themselves are unwilling to move them with so much as a finger. And I want to retranslate that. Rather, I think he says, I'd put it this way, they bind up heavy, indeed unbearable burdens and place them on men's shoulders, but they themselves are not willing to move those same burdens by so much as a finger. And I think the by so much as a finger, I've concluded that it's a measure of distance that he's, the sense in which he uses that. He's not saying that they're not using their finger to move the burden. What he's saying is, we would say an inch. They're not even willing to move it an inch. And yet they're tying up these heavy burdens and placing them on men's shoulders and saying, carry that. But they themselves are not willing to even budge their own burden. Now, what is he talking about? The imagery, obviously, is of freight carrying, tying up bundles of goods, placing them on the shoulders of somebody, but having them be so weighty, so immense in proportion that you couldn't possibly carry them. You'd be crushed under the load of these burdens. And yet he's saying that's what Phariseeism has done. It's crushed people with the burden that it has placed on them. So they're sitting there telling you, urging you, unless you bear this burden, you cannot inherit the kingdom of God. And yet he says, I don't see them moving their burden. They're not even nudging it an inch, a finger's width. Okay, what is he talking about? I think what he's talking about is when I got ahead of myself, the attitude of Phariseeism was, you want eternal life? You want the divine blessing? You want the blessing of Abraham? Then you're going to have to make yourself worthy by keeping the covenant. Render yourself worthy, demonstrate yourself worthy by keeping the requirements of the Mosaic covenant. And Jesus is liking that to a crushing, unbearable burden that he's placing on human beings. And he says, and you're not willing to do that at all. Now, why does he say that? The difference between a Pharisee and the plain old ordinary person in the land is the Pharisees, what makes a Pharisee, what makes someone a successful, effective member of any Pharisaical culture, is their skill at self-deception. I can tell people, you must make yourself worthy by practicing and keeping the covenant, if I believe that I am keeping the covenant. If I take my own message seriously, and I recognize that I can't keep the covenant, my message gets reduced to a whisper pretty quickly, because I realize how can I be telling all of these people that they must demonstrate their worthiness by the covenant when I am so unworthy? How can I demonstrate my worthiness before the covenant? It's impossible. I am a perverse, evil, self-centered, defensive human being. And there's no way in the world I can measure up to the standard of goodness that I find in the covenant. And when I recognize that about myself, how can I, in all seriousness, recommend to others, there's the way you're going to find eternal life? But what if, in self-deception, I look at my own life and I'm able to say to myself, I'm a good person. I am righteous. I am godly. I am loving. I love justice. I love truth. I'm a champion of that which is good and pure. And out of that self-perception, then I can say to other people, so you be like me. You're weak. You're miserable. You're a slave of sin. Well, okay. Dig down deep and try harder and become like me, like I did. Then I can say that kind of thing. And I don't really perceive it as putting an unbearable burden on other people, because I don't feel it as an unbearable burden myself. But Jesus' critique of the Pharisees is, remember how often he uses the word blind later in the chapter? His critique of Phariseeism is, but the reason you don't feel it as an unbearable burden is because you are clueless. You don't see yourself the way you really are. You see yourself as worthy, but you are hopelessly unworthy. And if you were to take the law seriously enough, the law would show you that you are unworthy, but you don't actually keep the law. You don't actually take the law seriously. You ignore vast portions of it, so of course you can lie to yourself and effectively deceive yourself. Let me just pause here for a second. I think this is an incredibly apt message for us in mainstream Christianity today. And I don't mean the fringes. You know, I don't mean the weird, bizarre, fanatical, half-crazy fringes of evangelical Christianity. I mean mainstream, decent Christianity. A lot of godly men and women in mainstream, decent Christianity. But the attitudes, the things we say from the pulpit, the things we say in the Sunday school classes, the things we say to one another in our encouragement to one another and so on, are rooted in the same kind of mentality that Jesus is attacking here. Just do better. Just be a better person. You got to be a good witness. You got to be a good example. You got to, you know, yeah, we've heard them all. All of them are predicated on the assumption that in the final analysis, Christianity is about me deciding to be a good, committed follower of Jesus. And the thing that we have to understand is that that's not Christianity. That's Christian Phariseeism. Christianity is this good news message about we who are so hopeless in our evil that the demands of the law will be perceived by us as an unbearable burden. The good news is God is going to have mercy on me and give me eternal life anyway. That's the message of Christianity. That's the gospel. And as recipients of that kind of mercy, then, we go out into the world with new eyes, with eyes to see how unbearable that same burden is to everybody else out there as well. And therefore, my attitude toward them is to extend the same mercy toward them that I have received from God. And out of that mercy, to be understanding and to be one who's eager to proclaim the good news of the mercy of God to others as well. That's the faith. Not this religion that we're coming into the world to bring and to give and to impart and to promote and to advocate for. Run out of time. One other verse, and then I'll open it up to your comments and questions. Let's also look at, where is it? There we go, 23. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you tithe mint and dill and cumin. Am I pronouncing that right? those of you cooks. Is that cumin? Is that right? Okay. Mint and dill and cumin, and have neglected the weightier provisions of the law, justice and mercy and faithfulness. But these are the things you should have done without neglecting the others. I have always read that as, in the law, there are little trivial religious ceremonial things that are prescribed, or are, what's the word, commanded. And then there are huge, big moral issues that are commanded. And which of these commandments are we going to obey? Are we going to obey the ceremonial ones? Or are we going to obey the command to love justice and to act justly and to love mercy and to act in mercy and to be faithful to both God and other people? And I think that's how our translators must have read this verse because of the way they've translated it, that we need to pay more attention to the demand that we be just and the demand that we be merciful and the demand that we be faithful than we are attentive to the demand that we tithe all these trivial little things in our lives. The problem with that is that none of the words seem to be translated right. The word they translated, justice, chrysis, I can't find anywhere else in the New Testament or the Septuagint where justice would be the appropriate translation of that. It means judgment. And usually, not always, but oftentimes in the sense of the condemnation that you're going to receive at judgment. It's the judgment of God. It's the term that's used in that phrase over and over again, the day of judgment that is coming. So I think the weightier provisions of the law are, it's not provisions even, it's just the weightier things of the law. Judgment, the term that's translated mercy, I think that's okay. I looked long and hard to see that word eleos often is a translation of the word hesed, the Hebrew word hesed, and I wondered whether that's not the case here as well, but I think I persuaded myself that no, he means mercy. Judgment and mercy, and then the word they translated faithfulness is the plain old ordinary Greek word that's always translated faith. And so I think there's no reason it shouldn't be translated that way here. In fact, although there are probably three or four times where the word is translated faithful in the New American Standard Version, none of those places seem like bona fide translations to me. I have yet to find a place where pistis really, I think, ought to be translated faithful. I'm not convinced it can mean faithful or ever does mean faithful. So what are these weightier things of the law? Judgment, mercy, and faith. Well, if I'm understanding rightly what Jesus is saying here, this is a crucial, crucial claim that Jesus is making. I mean, he's basically analyzing the ultimate purpose and intent of the covenant. What does it boil down to, he says? That you come to terms that through the covenant, a human being come to terms with the reality of divine condemnation, divine judgment, and condemnation for the evil person that I am, the reality of divine mercy, the fact that God is going to meet me at the point of my unworthiness and damnable state. He's going to respond to that in mercy. At least he's fully willing and capable of doing that. And then thirdly, what is it that it marks the person who's going to receive the mercy of God? Faith, what we call faith. So the mark is that we believe the truth that is revealed to us by God, whatever in whatever form that takes. Well, that pretty much captures it. And that the point, what Jesus is saying is, you guys have got sidetracked into doing religion over here, and you're meticulous about tithing your spices, but the whole point that the covenant was given is totally lost on you. You're not reckoning with the reality of divine condemnation and divine judgment. You guys don't think you have anything to be judged for. The whole purpose of the covenant was to show you, was to rub your nose in your own evil, to bring you to a point where you would finally get it, that you are a damnable creature. That was the whole point of the covenant, and that's been lost on you. You guys didn't get that part. A second part of the covenant was the covenant is shot full of pointers to the mercy of God. And have you guys gotten it? You guys are clueless about the mercy of God. You guys are still trying to make yourself worthy of the divine blessing. There's no room for mercy in your system except in words. I mean, you might talk about mercy, but at any sort of profound, in-depth level, at the level of your real understanding, you're not counting on the mercy of God. You're counting on your own religious worthiness. So that's been lost on you as well. And faith, you don't understand that the people who are going to receive the mercy of God are simply the people who believe what God has revealed to them is true, not those people who are religious and demonstrate their piety in an attempt to demonstrate their worthiness. None of the most important things that the law had to teach you have you even grasped. So then when he says, "You blind guides who strain out a gnat and swallow a camel." I'll double check my notes here. What has misled you is your selective perception of the law. You focus on and concentrate on relatively unimportant, insignificant, trivial little commandments, and you have totally ignored the larger commandments of the law, and that's how you have deceived yourselves. The same thing happens in Christian culture today. How often do we see people emphasizing how you look, what you wear, how you talk, what language you speak in, you know, what words come out of your mouth, what you smoke, what you drink, what you don't smoke, what you don't drink, whether you bowl or not. I mean, those are the issues that preoccupy us. And yet, the issues that really are the barometer, the measure of my the commitments of my heart are, do I love my neighbor? Do I love justice? Do I love mercy and compassion? Those are the things that count. Those are the things that measure me for who I am. But those are the things we don't even look at. That's the camel we're swallowing while we strain out the gnats. And so Jesus is criticizing them for that practice that leads to their self-deception. I'm going to run out of time, so let me stop here. There's a lot more we could talk about, but let me stop here for your comments and questions.
Will you talk maybe a little bit about the last section of 23? It says, these are the things you should have done without neglecting the others.
Okay,
yeah. The others, the cumin and the mint and everything?
Yeah. Let me again retranslate that. Sorry, just a second. I need to find my place. These things it is necessary to pursue without overlooking the others. These things it is necessary to live in the light of without overlooking the religious requirements, I think is what he means. That is, I can see why the translators went the way that they did. When he talks about you should have done these things, well, how do you do condemnation and how do you do mercy and how do you do divine condemnation? How do you do divine mercy? How do you do faith? Well, obviously you can do faith, but how do you do the other two? Do is a very, very, the Greek word for do is a very widely used word that gets used with a lot of different nuances. And I think he's just using it in the sense of you should have lived paying attention to these things and without neglecting the religious requirements of the law. It's fine to do the religious requirements of the law, but you need to do the other stuff as well. And he's speaking loosely there, I think. You need to do them in the sense that you need to behave and conduct yourself in the light of these realities. The reality is you are worthy of divine condemnation. The reality is God is a merciful God who will act toward you mercifully anyway. And you should have lived your life in the light of that.
So is, I mean, both from that and from like the, you should clean the inside of the cup so that the outside may become clean also. I mean, is Jesus kind of like just, I mean, he's saying you've put all the weight over here, but you should have put all the weight over here. Like you've put all the weight on doing the religious things and ignored the real relationship with God or something like that, and you should have put all the weight on that and everything else would have followed or something like that?
Yeah, I'm not sure I can answer the question in that form. Let me just talk about that. Why do we treat the requirements of the law differently? Why do we focus on ritual, ceremony, religiosity, and downplay morality? Because you don't have to be a good person to be religious. In fact, the longer I live, the more religious a person comes across to me, the more I suspect that they are hopelessly evil. I mean, there's this incredible correlation between this real darkness in the person's soul and how pious and religious they are on the outside, an incredible correlation that is seems to me no accident. The people that are not religious are just in some kind of despair. They're not trying to deceive themselves. They just have this message coming at them from Christian or Jewish culture telling them, be good, be good, be good. If you're not good, you're going to die. You're going to be condemned. And out of that message, they go, then I'm going to be condemned. I mean, they're just crushed by the burden of that message. And that's why the gospel is such good news, because the gospel is, you can't be good. I know you can't be good, but God can be merciful, and God will be merciful. So if you are committed to self-deception, and not everybody is, but if you're committed to self-deception, you're going to gravitate toward highlighting, underlining, and emphasizing the religious and ceremonial aspects of the law that are doable by even an evil person like me. And I'm going to kind of sweep under the rug the moral requirements of the law that there's no way in the world I could possibly measure up to them. Now, I'm not going to deny them. Obviously I'm going to give verbal assent to them being there, but I'm never going to focus my gaze on the question, have you loved your neighbor as yourself, Jack? But I will focus my gaze on, have I ever drunk any alcohol? Have I ever smoked any tobacco? Have I ever done any drugs? Have I ever danced? Have I ever gone to movies? Have I ever played cards? Whatever your taboo of choice is. So this whole discussion about the inside versus the outside is the outside is the way in which they have made themselves appear pious, godly, righteous, through very doable ceremonial things, but they have never even paid any attention to the commitments of their heart. You as a person, what do you really love? What do you really value? What are you really committed to? Are you committed to purity? Are you committed to righteousness? Are you committed to justice? Are you committed to truth? Well, all that stuff, they haven't done any business cleaning up their commitments, but they have done all kinds of work on creating a facade of religious and ceremonial piety and godliness. So that's the inside-outside that he's talking about.
Okay. I think my question, though, is like, do you think that Jesus is saying in either of those verses that religion will follow from cleaning from after you?
I don't think he's addressing that.
Commitments.
I don't think he's saying anything clearly one way or the other about that. My opinion, because I don't think that's the question he's addressing in this passage. The question he's addressing is the dynamic of their self-deception and how that has played itself out in their lives. The closest thing he says to actually addressing that question is when he says, "These are the things you should have done without neglecting the others." I think he's honoring the religion that is in the Mosaic Covenant. And he's saying the Mosaic Covenant is the Mosaic Covenant, and God gave the whole Mosaic Covenant and expected the Jews to keep it. So should you keep it in all of its detail? Well, yeah, sure. So he is saying that. But I think we would make a huge mistake there if we assumed that for us as Gentile believers, that translates into, if you're really going to be a child of God, you're going to be religious with some kind of religiosity. I don't think that follows, because the reason they were to be religious is because religion was commanded by the covenant that God made with Israel. God didn't make a covenant with me comparable to the covenant he made with Israel. God has never required of me that I be religious as a Gentile.
Okay, thanks.
Time for one more.
I really enjoyed you pointing that out. I think that the discussion from Thursday was interesting to me because it is very difficult to deal with because I believe religion is a security blanket to protect us from the fear of discovering how much we like immorality.
Yeah.
Once we discover we like immorality, it contradicts the idea that we've joined to self-preservation. That is the idea that we're good people and that we aren't this way. And when we discover that we really are through traumatic situations and see, one of the problems that some of the combat veterans that I talk with deal with is that they discovered how much they like the power of killing. Mm-hmm. And they go the rest of their lives dealing with the guilt. Well, that guilt arises out of coming back to a culture that is in great denial. Recognize, to survive, we need to practice goodness, but not do so religiously to the extent that we deny. Well, that's all well said and good. I mean, well said, and we preach on that, but at the same time, this is why the gospel truly is. In fact, I was reading the verse there. It says justice, mercy, and faith. It's translated faithfulness, but there's a definite article in front of the faith, as you probably read. And that puts the faith, that particular, again, that it makes it that particular gift which is given to us by God to be able to see who God is. Mm-hmm. And I think Jesus all along is pointing out that he alone is the only one that is acceptable by way of practice.
Right.
And this is truly a great chapter on dealing with self-deception.
Yeah. We've got to go, but just one brief comment. The point that George is making about we are so perverse that when it comes right down to it and we really ultimately get to the core of who we are, we even love our perversity. It's in coming to see that that we come to realize how hopeless it is that we could ever, from out of ourselves and from within ourselves, ever become worthy of God. And until we see that, we don't know ourselves. And until we know ourselves, we can't possibly understand the glory and the magnitude of God's grace and mercy toward us. And it just seems to me that the most important feature of our sanctification, of our coming to faith, of our coming to wisdom, the most important feature is my coming to know myself first, how fundamentally perverse I am. When I see that, then I see me. And when I see me, then I'm finally in a position to do the right kind of business with God. So that's crucial. And that's the very thing that Phariseeism stands against. It's a whole culture that is fortified to agree together with me. It's this kind of agreement that we have. Let's all deceive ourselves together. Let's send the message instead. We can do this. We can do this thing for God. But there couldn't be a more diabolical lie than that. He'd let you go. Thanks.